This season of the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is proudly supported by My Music Staff.
Welcome to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the place where teachers from around the world meet to share innovative ideas about music education. Listen and learn as we help you motivate your students, grow your income, expand your studio, and become a more creative piano teacher.
Welcome back to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, episode number 156 of season 1, 2019. My name is Tim Topham, your host for the show, and a very special welcome if this is your first time here. The Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is your home for inspiration, ideas, business, and teaching strategies to help support your teaching and grow your studio. And a very special welcome, as always, to my Inner Circle Piano Teaching Community members. So today's guest is someone who you have already met a few times on the podcast. He's also been on some of my expert chit chats, other interviews and webinars, and I'll be introducing him in just a moment. But I know you're going to enjoy today's discussion because it's always great when I interview this teacher, particularly when he's in front of a piano as he is today. The topic today is all about improvisation and particularly pattern-based improvisation. So we'll discuss a little bit about how that might be different from other approaches to improvising and how you could get started with that in your studio if you'd like to. Today's show notes and a full transcript are now available at timtopham.com/episode154. Many of you will know my guest today. He's a pianist, educator, and the author of the Pattern Play series on improvisation. He also wrote the new Create First series and also Puzzle Play on the art of arranging. He travels around the world helping others make music education more enjoyable and creative. Well, welcome back to the show, Forrest Kinney.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
It's always a pleasure hanging out with you. And we just had some delightful tech issues, which our listeners are now... Well, they're none the wiser for because it's all solved now, but it's really great to see you. And look, a lot has happened since you were last on the show way back in episode number 104 because we had you on for an expert chit chat, which is one of my private interviews for Inner Circle members. You created a full course for us on lead sheet playing, which has been incredibly popular. We did a live webinar and blew up the system. We couldn't fit enough attendees into the system. You've released a whole lot of your own new books and even a book of essays and writing that you've done on the topic of music, and you've joined us as an expert in the Inner Circle community. So thank you for all that you've been contributing to both the Inner Circle and also the books and things that you're putting out. Sounds like you've had a pretty busy time.
You know, I'm exhausted just listening to all that. Can I take a nap before we resume? Wow. Yeah, no, I put out 8 books last year, so I really am a little tired of writing books, but I'm very glad I put them out. So.
Yeah. Well, it was actually a bit of a self-imposed exile, wasn't it, in order to do the books, because you did no conferences or anything last year. So we're going to see you around a bit more this year. You're coming out of your hibernation?
Yes. I'm emerging from my cave. I'm re-entering civilization. I'm going to be at the National Music Teachers Conference here in the States next month. And my duet partner and I are giving a concert at the California MTAC, which I've seen you at a couple times. You were there last year.
Yes. Yeah. Great conference. I like that.
Yeah. It's a fantastic conference. Mm. And I'm going to be working with Bradley Sowash and Leela Viss at their camp, which you've also done. I guess I'm following your footsteps.
Yeah, just following me.
Yeah. I'm just stalking you. It's looking to be one of my more normal years, and I'm turning off the computer hopefully here sometime soon.
Right. Well, not before you're actually going to be joining us for another webinar too, which is very exciting news. We'll make sure we increase our webinar capacity because I know it will be very popular, and you're going to be talking about what we're talking about today, which is pattern-based improvisation. So let's dive into this topic a little bit now. And look, many of our listeners will know you from your Pattern Play books, which I know many teachers will have on their shelves, actually. So tell us, what is this pattern-based improv all about, and how's it different to normal improv?
That's a really good place to begin, because traditionally, I mean, let's say you could transport yourself back 300 or so years and study with J.S. Bach, which would be quite something. Mm. you know, if he taught you to improvise, the basic approach that he used is really what jazz people still use today and most classical teachers use, which is to begin by teaching you how to play tunes and then teaching you harmony and how to put them together, how to style tunes. And then, of course, on the repeats, you're expected to do something different. There's a scholar who said only a dull dog repeats, you know, something on the, you know, at the same on repeat. You are always expected to vary, embellish, add something new. And so improvisation basically grew out of what I call the art of arranging. First, you played a tune. And then later, after you learned all that stuff, you learned how to embellish, maybe add a blues note, that sort of thing. So can you hear me okay, by the way, with the piano?
All right. It's great.
Very good. All right. So there's a real problem. Well, there's a beauty of that approach, which is it's the most practical approach because, I mean, if you're a church musician or you're out playing gigs, people want to hear familiar tunes. And so your improvisation is layered upon all these nice arrangements you've come up with. But as you can imagine, there is a serious drawback with this approach, which is it's completely off limits to a beginner because you've got to know how to play a tune. You've got to know chords. You've got to know how to style. You have to know how to coordinate. I mean, we're talking years into the process. So what's been needed for hundreds of years is a very simple pattern-based approach where even first day beginners can learn to improvise. And that's basically what I 1992, I sat down at a computer and started writing pattern play to fill that void.
And so the Create First and your other, your subsequent books, they've built on the same approach or have they gone in a completely different direction? How do they kind of link together?
Yeah. Good question. Because I started publishing pattern play in 2004 and did three books with about 231 patterns to create with in every conceivable style. Because one thing I try to get in people's minds right away is improvisation is in any style, not just jazz and blues or in the style of classical. And those were geared towards a solo pianist because at the time I was kind of a solo player and thought in those terms. But then I started playing duets with people and it changed my life. And I began to discover something I now call the duet to solo approach, which is basically if the teacher provides a duet environment, that is a very safe, welcoming, harmonic environment for a student, that's when the first day beginners can sit down and play. The teacher says, you know, the teacher might start by playing this and say, just make sounds with me on black keys. And any beginner can make sounds by exploring. And so what I discovered is that the duet approach was really the way to go, which then morphed into the solo. So then I wrote another pattern play series, which unfortunately I called by the same name, pattern play, because it's such a good name, I refused to let go of it, but it's caused way too much confusion. And that series is published by the Royal Conservatory of Music. And in that series, each piece is presented first as a duet, so the teacher can play a duet with the student. Then you turn the page, and there's a solo version. So the same piece can be played solo. Then you turn the page, and there is a trio version so that small groups, trios, quartets, can play together. And that's the real advantage of that series, is you have those different modalities. But then I found that the pieces were not really, a lot of them, that beginnery.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of teachers were saying, look, blues on black is a great pattern, but I don't have too many beginners who can play that solo. They can do a duet, but not solo. So then I created Create First so that it had simpler patterns. It was better organized to teach all the scales and intervals and modes and chords. And it was available in PDF form so that you there in Australia could buy it instantly because I had few people complain to me justifiably that it costs more to ship than they could imagine. And they're going to have to mortgage their house and sell their children to get, you know, these books. And being that I didn't want children sold, I thought I'm going to make these available as PDF. So that's what the Create First series is. It's once again formatted as duet and solo, but now duet and solo are in separate books so that teachers have their own book and students have their own solo book they can take home.
I don't know about you, but one of the things that I find hardest is that jump between a student just doing a bit of right hand twinkling on the black keys, which I love doing in lessons, the jump to then playing solo hands together and keeping often a consistent rhythm in the left hand is a real struggle. So have you got any tips there, any ideas?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I agree with you, Tim. That is the issue. And I've had many students, like I have a student now named Lydia, who just turned 9, and she loves to play duets with me. And I mean, we could spend the whole lesson doing duets, but can I get her to play solo? Even though she's a good player, no, she just kind of refuses. And it's because of that darn two-handed coordination thing. Mm. But the basic approach I use is we play duets until they gain a certain fluency with their right hand. Then what I call the duet to solo approach, I say, hey, I want to play the top part. I mean, you're getting all the fun up there. I'm just down here playing accompaniments. So we trade places and I teach them to play a left-hand accompaniment, just the left hand while I'm improvising. So let's say I teach them to do maybe a simple fifth like this. And then I'm up here improvising. Then I say, okay, you know how to play the right hand. You know how to play the left hand. I think you're old enough and wise enough to try to put it together at home. And they go, oh, no. And I say, okay, here's the technique that works for everybody. And it really does. Though the coordination of the two sides is difficult, if people play in exactly the same rhythm, it's not. It's just like hitting a log with a stick with both hands.
Yeah.
So what I say to the student is, okay, with that pattern, we're just going to do the same rhythm in both hands. So everybody I've ever worked with has been successful with that. And then we might try doing something like, okay, well now, you know, sustain a note once in a while, like. So again, we're working with simple either extensions of the beat or subdivisions of the beat, like maybe playing eighth notes. Then we tend to work with sequences. So for example, if we're doing a pattern, say for example, this, it's a pattern in my Create First book called Don't Give Up. It uses the blues scale in a rock style. The bass is simple, it's just an E flat. And the scale is simple, it's just black keys and any A natural. And together, that makes what's called an E flat blues scale. So I'll give a student a simple rhythm like, and I'll have them try that until they've got it. And then I'll suggest that they turn that into what we musicians call a sequence, which is the same rhythm like playing it on different pitches. And so incrementally building up their vocabulary of two-handed coordination. So there's a couple of techniques that I found to be really successful.
I like that. The other one that I use is to get students to play something sustained in the left hand. So maybe just on beat 1 or 1 and 4 perhaps, and then do the little improv between those when they play. So maybe that's like 1, 2, 3, 4. So they do a big chord down the bottom, boom, do some improv and left hand. So it's still not playing together, but it's starting to get them to understand that they're playing solo. They're just not playing at the same time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And actually you reminded me of a similar technique, which is this, just having them play whole notes in the right hand. Kind of taking what you just said and then moving it a little closer to putting the hands together.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I think another mistake that I've often made is because I like doing 12-bar blues improv quite early on with students and getting them to use a blues scale, it seems natural in my head to then say, okay, well, let's try and do that hands together. But as you've just explains, blues and swing is probably one of the harder ones to coordinate together because it only really sounds good if it's a bit funky and off the beat. So to start with non-jazz, non-blues is probably a better approach.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. The essence of those styles is really a syncopated rhythm, and that is challenging, even for teachers to often.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really love the opportunity to teach students about theory through practical experience. So do you use that approach as well?
You know, I teach almost all theoretical concepts now through improvising with it first. So for example, give me something that you might, you know, like say a Dorian scale or a major seventh chord.
Yeah, let's go with a dominant seventh chord.
Okay, all right. Well, there's an easy one because, you know, it can be used with the blues or whatever. But if I want a student to really understand something from a musical point of view, I want them to create with it first. So I want them to understand the unique character of a dominant seventh chord is that diminished fifth or tritone, or what in medieval theorists called diabolus in musica, you know, the devil in music, that dissonant interval. And I want them to understand that that's the essence of that harmony. So I might have them just play like root, third, seventh. And I might talk to them about how traditionally that always resolved that interval. But in the blues, you've got that intense longing. And so there's never a resolution of that. So the blues consists of one dominant seventh chord going to another. So I might have them do a very simple blues with the dominant, or I might have them do a very simple, or in addition, I should say, a very simple Mozart pattern. And we might improvise with that to get the character. So then we talk about, okay, well, now how can you make a D7? How can you make a G7? What's the pattern that's common to all these dominant seventh chords?
Right. So it's about experiencing the sound of a new structure before you then go, okay, well, so this is how you calculate it and this is how you play it in all its positions.
That's it. You want to get them excited and into the world of the musical experience. And then they see theory. I always say that there's two ways to teach theory. There's a way to use it to expand the creative possibilities, or a way to use it to constrict or the musical possibilities. And sadly, the way I was taught theory at a few different institutions was it was very rule-bound. Like, this is how it's done. Whereas theory can be wonderfully expansive. I mean, for example, with that dominant seventh chord, you can say, well, you know, now that you know how to make a dominant seventh chord, you can do cool things like sliding from the five chord if you're in this key. If you want to go five to four, you can slide down. So you're expanding the possibilities. And that's why I love theory so much, is because when I play a chord, I think, wow, I can add a second to that chord, or I can add a major seven, or maybe both, or I can substitute it 6-9 chord, or I could endless possibilities.
Now, a quick word from our sponsor, My Music Staff. Most of you have already heard about My Music Staff and how their software helps thousands of music teachers manage their businesses more efficiently. They handle all of your student management issues, scheduling, billing, and so much more. It's what I personally use in my own studio, and it's no surprise why it's the leading studio management software. What I think really makes My Music Staff stand out is its community-driven development and personal approach to customer support. It was such a pleasant surprise jumping into My Music Staff for the first time and realizing how in tune it was with my business and the ins and outs of a music studio. Since they partner with the music community to develop their software, they've been able to anticipate what teachers need and are constantly improving their software to exceed expectations. And a more recent example of responding to community feedback was the addition of a very popular feature, streaming video and audio files directly within the My Music Staff app. And that means that no longer do you have to download files to your device. So it makes it incredibly easy to share content with your students. My Music Staff is super easy to get up and running. The transition away from paper and spreadsheets is painless. If you do need help, the quality of support is second to none, and you'll always get a fully personalized response. I have yet to see the level of attention and care I receive from my music staff provided by any other software platforms I use. And I use a lot of software in my business. So what have you got to lose? Just go to mymusicstaff.com and sign up for their free 30-day trial today. And I was talking to Glory St. Germain from Ultimate Music Theory in episode 2 this season about how I love one structure in music that I find can be traditionally taught so badly because it's all so formulaic is cadences.
Oh.
Most theory courses, you have to do four-part harmony, cadential movement, right? And you just learn the rules, don't you? It's like a maths equation. So I'm interested to know how do you, that's a structure that I'd be fascinated to know how you explain or explore with students.
Well, again, that's it. You see, to me, the essence of a cadence would be all the different types of resolution or partial resolution or non-resolution. So, and I would, you know, maybe talk with students about how it compares to a comma and a period and a semicolon, all these, and or a dash, all these different ways of punctuating speech. We have similar ways with cadences. Do we come to a complete sense of resolution by ending with the root? Or do we end with the third to kind of give a sense of open possibility? So then I would have them improvise with these different ways, again, to experience and feel it. If they don't feel it, I don't care how much knowledge you have. If you have no feeling, I mean, it really doesn't help you create.
Mm. What about the teachers who are listening and going, oh, Forrest, this all sounds so good, but I just don't have time. They've got a theory exam coming up in 2 months. They just need to know this stuff. I just got to get it out there. They've got a recital coming up. What do you say? Because I know that is a really big problem for a lot of teachers.
Oh, it's a huge problem. You know, I would, oh boy, we're treading dangerous waters here. I would say, from my point of view, what's the big picture? It's a lifelong love of learning. And to me, I've been making music for 50 years, and I still sit down at the piano, and I look at the piano, and I get excited. It's like, ooh, what am I going to discover today? Like right before we talked, I discovered the coolest thing in A-flat Lydian, and I love that key, but I found something totally new just now. And so what is our real goal in teaching, isn't it to instill that delight, that lifelong love of delight? So after 50 years, that student will still have that delight. And so if that's our goal, then next week's theory exam would be put in that context. And so I would tend to say, teach that experiential, teach that discovery first, and the knowledge will come later and not kill the discovery. But if the knowledge comes too soon, it tends to kill that delight in discovery. So I guess what I'm saying from my little ivory tower here, and I do live in a black, I call it an ebony and ivory tower, is, you know, put these essentials first. That's my argument.
That's right. And the experiential learning, there is no doubt that the research all tells us that students will learn best from experiencing things, trying to teach you back things that you've taught them. Now, these are the ways that knowledge really sinks in the most. It's not by sitting at a desk and doing the theory. I mean, sometimes, yes, you have to do that. You have to learn to write a note, but the more we can do it practically, I think the better. So I'm with you on that. What about things like listening, rhythm, dynamics? Do you cover those in your improvising as well?
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned listening. I don't know of any better way to teach listening, creative listening, that it's, to me, creative listening is listening that is responsive. In other words, I can hear this B flat and I'm listening to it, but responding to it is something very different. And that's what creativity is all about, is a new response. And I don't know any better way to teach that kind of listening than by improvising people. And I don't know any better way to teach rhythm than by playing rhythmic duets with people. I mean, that one I used earlier, that don't give up pattern. I'm playing that with a lot of my students now. And that left hand is just, again, hitting a log with a stick, and they're getting the beat. Mm. And I've had students who really have no sense of pulse, who you do this with them week after week. You just play quarter notes together, finding the beat together, and everybody eventually starts feeling that pulse. I had one student who was incapable of rhythm. I mean, I tested my patience more than I think any student I've ever had. But after he finally got the beat, a year later, he was playing a Latin syncopated piece with me in the recital a year later. I mean, he was playing off the beat convincingly because he finally felt the beat he could play off.
I can see how that links in so well with this exploratory, improvisationary playing. And what about groups? Because I know you tend to teach one-on-one, but does this work in groups and how do things change?
Yeah, you know, because it's pattern-based, that is, it's built on short repeating accompaniments. By the way, I should mention that in my approach, there are patterns, which are these short repeating accompaniment figures. For example, something like Ireland would be. That's the pattern. And then there's always a contrasting accompaniment pattern, which provides a vacation or break from the pattern. So with that said, I should have mentioned that earlier. How does a group do this? Well, let's take Ireland. You divide up the keyboard into three parts. There's almost always a bass part. There's always an inner voice or harmony part in the middle. And then there's always a soloist on top, or not always, but usually. So in Ireland, I would give a student on the bottom a simple bass would just be right on the beat. I would encourage a little more advanced student to start dancing around the beat a bit. The student in the middle would play just simple triads. And again, a more advanced student, I would encourage it to vary that, to improvise with those notes. And then the student on top, I would encourage them to play with any white keys. So you get three kids playing together at once. But now, if you've got a group of six kids or five kids, I play a game I call musical chairs. So I have the three kids stand behind the three kids that are playing and watch them and listen. And then I have one rule in this, or two rules in the game, that you have to try all three parts eventually. So you take someone's place. So a kid standing behind the bass player and he says, okay, I think I'm ready to jump in. And he takes that bass part. The other rule is that you can't stop the beat, or you have to pay $50. So, and the kids, you know, they're like, $50? And I say, yeah, I'm pretty strict about this too. This is how I afford to go to Hawaii every year. $50 fines. So you get these kids moving around and trading places, and you don't script it. You just say, okay, you have to play all three parts. And little kids love to crawl under the grand piano. And you'll see they do all sorts of stuff. So that's a very fun way to teach groups.
It's a great one. And I was even thinking, if you've got multiple digitals in the room, you could have different people playing different sounding instruments too. That's a really easy approach. And yeah. So, and those, the three parts that you mentioned for Ireland, which book, can you remember which book that Irish pattern is in, for example?
Yeah, that's in Pattern Play Book 1, the one published by RCM, because now that's the series I mentioned that has most of the pieces show how to play it as trios or quartets.
Right. Great. So that'd be great for group teachers.
Oh, yeah. And I see, for example, like Ireland is great for teaching rhythm, but also for teaching triads. What a great introduction to triads, because you've got A minor root position, G major root position, repeating, and then F, G, A minor. So it's actually a really good one for beginners playing chords.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about styles, different styles for, I guess, for left hand in particular, for students, do you introduce those in some kind of structured way, or do you just kind of go, okay, well, next page is all about jazz and this one's a bit of blues and that's some classical?
You know, I think I structure it in two ways. I try to develop their vocabulary of musicality, first of all, and that's what the Create First series does in the first section, really tunes them into the difference between consonants and dissonance, loud and soft, high and low. I mean, the basic elements of musicality. And then the next thing I try to do is introduce them to the basic scales and modes. So we create with major scales, minor scales, the modes, all the modes on white keys, and then the major and the minor blues scales. And then we go into different intervals and different chords. So in that process, I do this in all sorts of different styles. So for example, introducing fourths, we would maybe do a piece called Pagoda. Are all fourths in the left hand on white, or in the right hand on white keys. Then we might do a piece called Fourth Dimension, where the left hand is in a Dorian mode and playing nothing but fourths. To give them a sense of, that fourths have another character.
Right, yes, because the first one was instantly had an Asian Oriental flavor. The second one had none of that. It just goes to show. Really interesting. That quartal harmony in the jazz in the left hand. Yeah, suddenly, yeah, different feel altogether.
Yeah, yeah. And I want people to have that experience with all the materials of music. For example, people tend to say that major is happy and minor is sad. And that always bothers me because, you know, a piece like this, minor blues scale, but I wouldn't call that sad. And likewise, here's a major piece. I wouldn't call that happy. To me, that's and introspective, and yet it's in C major and using mostly major chords. So I try to always introduce to students the idea that just like you, musical materials have many personalities and sides.
Mm. That's wonderful. Well, thank you very much for that sort of big overview and some great points in there that teachers could take away today and use in their studio and their teaching. I'm keen to know what's happening with the Create First series. Have you got more books coming? You did 8 last year. I don't know how you even do that. What's the plan?
Well, actually, it was a year before that I did the Create First series. Last year was all about puzzle play. Now that's series on arranging, and that's the one where you learn tunes and you learn styles and chords. So that's actually the kind of more of the traditional approach to improvisation. But the Create First series, yeah, I've only got 6 books in that, and I'm moving through the keys. So the level 1, which has a duet and solo, it's all on black keys and white keys. Level 2, it's intervals and chords on white keys. And then level 3, which I got done last summer, is keys with one sharp and all the modes. So E minor and C Lydian and D Mixolydian. And now I'm working on the next one, which is all the modes with one flat. And then there'll be 2 sharps and 2 flats and 3 sharps and 3 flats. And then I'm an old man with gray hair and a very sore back. But you know, I die satisfied that I've covered all the keys.
Very good. Well, we love all the resources that you're creating for us. And it's so good to hang out with you and chat again. Thank you so much for joining me today. Where can people go and find out more about your fantastic resources?
I have a website, which is named after me, coincidentally. It's www.forestkinney.com. And Forest is spelled with 2 R's, and Kinney is spelled K-I-N-N-E-Y. And there you can, you know, see sample pages. I have a sampler that's like 200 pages of pages from, I think, 37 of my different books. And that's a freebie. And there's videos that you can, that introduce all the different things. So it's you know, a pretty good resource in itself. And then, of course, you can help support my retirement by buying books too.
And you can also hang out with Forrest in my inner circle. He's one of our expert teachers there, answering questions and giving support to lots of our teachers. And we'll also see you on the webinar coming up really, really soon. Thank you so much in advance.
I'm really looking forward to that. The webinars with you have been a lot of fun.
I love them every time, and we get such a great response. So we'll be diving into this topic in more detail, you at the piano and me asking some hopefully interesting questions. Sounds like fun.
You always ask good questions. I hope I give you enough room to ask them. I tend to get up on my soapboxes.
So. No, it's okay. You can get down from your ivory tower occasionally. You'll be all right. Beautiful. Have a great evening, Forrest. Thank you so much for your time today.
All right. Thank you, Tim. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
See you later.
Yep. Bye-bye.
I do hope you enjoyed today's episode with Forrest. As always, I love hearing him play and just demonstrate things because it's just so natural for him. And I do hope you'll try out some of these ideas in your studio and perhaps even grab some of Forrest's resources, which I highly recommend. So next week on the podcast, we're talking about something a little bit different, actually. It's more of a business topic. And it's the kind of podcast and discussion that you'll find very, very interesting if you're feeling at all overwhelmed with all that you have to do in your studio. If you would really love to find a little bit more time to spend either working on your business instead of struggling in it, or perhaps you'd like to spend some more time either with your family or doing your own practice. It's all about how to hire what we call a virtual assistant. So I'm going to tell you more about what that is, how on earth it works, what you might pay them, and how to hire them in next week's episode. So if you have administrative tasks that you think someone else around the world could potentially help you with, and that might free up a little bit more time for you to spend on doing the things that you should be doing and not being overwhelmed with administrative tasks that someone else could do, then definitely tune in next week. I can't wait to share those ideas with you. My name is Tim Topham, and this is the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. Just before you go, if you've enjoyed today's show, I'd love for you to check out my Inner Circle Piano Teaching Community. It's the go-to resource for piano teachers looking to continue their professional development, connect with other teachers and experts around the world, and to access hundreds of world-class training resources, including our academy courses, lesson plans, teaching videos, technology help, and much more. Whether you're just starting out or have been working hard to build your studio for a while, the Inner Circle community will give you the skills, support, and confidence you need to grow the studio of your dreams. Whether that's just about teaching a small number of students one-on-one in your home, or about hiring a commercial space, employing other teachers, and building an entire music teaching empire. With courses on both the teaching and business side of running your studio, live coaching, and our thriving community forums, you can get quick answers to questions, set yourself challenges, get feedback on your ideas, and feel confident teaching in new and exciting ways. For more info and how to join us inside the circle, head over to timtopham.com/community today. I'll see you on the inside.
We'll conclude this evening's entertainment.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. We'd love to help take your teaching to the next level as a member of our supportive community. Use the coupon Piano Podcast for $100 off an annual membership of Tim's Inner Circle today. To find out more, head to timtopham.com/community.